And we've got David Smick with us tonight. The world is curved, hidden dangers to the global economy, and we're going to take your phone calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. David, what did you mean by Japanese housewives run the show financially? Explain that.
Well, you know, it's I spent a lot of time in Japan, it's very interesting. Well, first of all, in Japanese families, the salary man, you know, the Japanese have, the half of their population is pretty talented. Half the female half generally doesn't work. It's the housewives stay home, and the salary men typically work very, very long hours. And so traditionally, the housewives control the family finances, they're the matriarchs. And, you know, Japan is a huge saving country. And as Japan went into its lost decade of the 1990s, as you recall, Japan is similar to where we are today. The Bank of Japan, the central bank, slashed interest rates down to near zero during this process. From a level of beginning of about 6.5%, and suddenly the housewives collectively said, well, you know, we used to make supplement our income from 6.5% return on our savings, and suddenly now we're getting nothing from the savings, or we're getting less than 1%. And so it's remarkable that the Japanese housewives taught themselves how to invest through the internet in foreign bonds. And they became almost overnight a major force in the whole global currency market, which is the biggest market in the world. It's quite often among currency traders, the question will be, what are the housewives doing? Not that they all move together, but there is a kind of a sense that, well, if New Zealand bonds are paying a certain amount, they move into New Zealand bonds. Or if the U.S. Treasury debt is attractive, they move into that. Or they'll move into the German long-term bonds. So, you know, they totally bypass the government, because the government basically said, you know, there's nothing we can do for you. We're going to, we're slashing interest rates, and because our economy is faltering, and so now it's very interesting what's happening. And you say, you know, why is Japan going into such a deep recession, just like we are today? Well, it's not just that, you know, the global demand is plummeting and exports are plummeting. What's happening is that, and it's quite remarkable, the housewives, out of the control of the government, have decided that with the rest of the world now, you know, slashing interest rates, you know, the U.S. interest rates are near zero, and the British interest rates are coming down dramatically, and now the Europeans are cutting. Everybody's moving towards zero. It suddenly doesn't make sense for them to keep buying all these foreign bonds, since, you know, they're not going to yield much more than Japanese bonds. So they're moving the capital back home. Now, when that happens and they move, you know, they sell their foreign bonds, and, you know, it happens gradually. It's happened over the last. What does that do? Well, that strengthens their currency. But it's happening at the worst possible time. Because all of this stuff is connected. When the currency strengthens, in the case of Japan, of course, it's the yen. When the yen strengthens, that's terrible for the big Japanese corporations like Toyota and, you know, Canon and Mitsubishi, because that makes all their Japanese goods more expensive overseas, and so they can't sell. They can't be as creative, and that's why Toyota's in trouble for the first time, losing money. So Japan is actually going into a recession in part because the housewives have brought the money back home, and so it's whereas before they were sending capital, you know, and Japan's a big saving economy, they were sending capital all over the world. And so it shows you what people do. Well, if the government doesn't deliver, they take matters into their own hands. And in this case, the housewives said, you know, we're going to invest collectively.
Okay, let's go to some of the calls. Julia, driving around in Los Angeles, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hey, Julia, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
We're great. Thanks, son.
My statement in question is this. Anything the government takes over scares me because during the first Gulf War, weren't we paying $400 a hammer? And I think what we need is transparency if they take over the banks or whatever they take over. And how do we get that transparency, especially since we're supplying the money? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, there it goes.
Well, I think she's right to be skeptical. I mean, you know, a classic example, part of it is George Bush didn't have the leadership, but, you know, even our efforts at a hurricane cleanup during Katrina, I mean, it was kind of government in action. It was pathetic. And so, I mean, there, you know, is right. There is a huge transparency. I think another classic case is, you know, the U.S. Treasury over the last year during this crisis, you know, had no vision, came up with a bailout plan and had to keep mending the plan and come, you know.
And no accountability, did
no accountability, just an ad hoc approach where one minute the idea was to use the $700 billion to remove all the toxic waste from the bank balance sheets. Then it was, without any accountability, then they just abruptly decided one day, no, we're going to buy, you know, stock, you know, preferred stock in the banks as a means of injecting capital. By the way, you know, typical government, nobody bothered to say, you know, they should have sent the Western Union telegram to each bank saying, by the way, I'm the Treasury Secretary. If we give you all these billions of dollars, do you promise to lend the money? Nobody bothered to send the telegram, you know, before wiring the money. And so, you know, it's not reassuring that government has a huge, you know, brilliant strategy on what to do.
Next up, we'll go to Houston, Texas, first-time caller. Hey, Dwight, go ahead.
Hi, David. How are you doing tonight?
Good. Thanks for calling. Good.
I was just wondering, I heard part of it earlier when my question was, it's like, you know, you're saying that the financiers were at fault, but it was basically Congress and during the Clinton administration, that's what I've understood, the Justice Department that was threatening these banks with investigations and stuff if they didn't lend the money, even though the banks knew, you know, people couldn't pay back the loans they were going for.
No, I agree with you that there's a lot of blame to spread around. I think that most people, you know, they're pretty much aware that there was huge political pressure to lend money to people for mortgages, and these are people who couldn't afford the mortgages. And it wasn't just from, you know, one party; it was from both parties. You know, we thought we had discovered, you know, riskless risk, and we were in this kind of never land period. But one of the things that I think is not mentioned is that how this problem, you know, is bigger than just that we lent money to people who couldn't afford to pay back some mortgages. I mean, look, go back to August 2007 when this began. We had basically a $200 billion subprime problem, maybe 300, some would say, of which at the time, you know, even if 30% was defaulting, you're talking a $60 to $90 billion problem with an overall market of $300 billion. Okay, that would have been 6 weeks of, you know, ugly financial markets, right? It wouldn't have brought the entire global financial system to its knees in the worst crisis since the 30s. It had to be more than just we lent money to people who couldn't afford mortgages. And I think what I say in my book, The World is Curved, is that this was a crisis that was more fundamental. It was a crisis in our financial architecture. It was a crisis in our accounting rules. It was a crisis in the whole way we evaluate risk and give risk a report card because we use these credit rating agencies that are frankly a sham and are not credible. And so You know, it was a crisis all around in how we operate money and how we control leverage. And it was these are bigger, more fundamental issues that I tried to describe. And that's why this thing mushroomed into a crisis of such historic proportion.
Indeed, indeed. Next up, let's go to west of the Rockies, Olin, in Culver City, California. Your turn, Olin.
Yes, the banks have to pay their depositors the current interest rate. How can the banks make low-interest loans when they know the Federal Reserve Bank Corporation is going to raise interest rates as soon as the economy starts to recover?
Yeah, that's a good point. They will. You know, that goes back to the whole question we were talking earlier about, you know, the potential for a bond market bubble. You know, once the economy recovers and the Fed is drastically raising rates, you know, all those loans and all the bonds in particular that are predicated on the interest rates remaining low forever will suddenly come under big pressure. Their prices will come under pressure, and you could suddenly have a collapse in that market. So, yeah, no, it is very, very it's very problematic. I think on the the most important thing right now, from what I could see, is to try to get mortgage rates down close to 2.5 or even close to 4.5 or even 4. And to take the risk, and if it were me, I would have the banks use their bailout money, at least the first round, and to buy, as I mentioned before, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac debt, and that would put pressure on those interest rates and bring them down, because if they get down to that level, you would see mortgage refinancings, and that's mortgage refinancings is one way to quickly, you know, get stimulation into the economy.
Okay, next up, let's go to Heath in Maryland, east of the Rockies. Heath, go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
David, I share your concern about the situation, but let me preface my question with a statement. The Credit Reinvestment Act was passed in 1967, and it loosened up a great deal of funds to folks that otherwise would not have received money for housing. For the most part, for some 20 years, this bill did exactly what it was supposed to do. And these folks often paid 50% of their household income, if not more. And they did it regularly, and they did it without any problem. It wasn't until Wall Street got involved in this scam that this whole thing blew up.
Yeah, I mean, I the whole issue in my book, I talk about how the whole process of financial liberalization actually, for the most part, was a positive. It started under President Carter in the late 70s, and we saw the liberalization, the freeing up of financial markets, and allow people it became a much more efficient financial system, and it was and the idea was to make it easier to finance entrepreneurial risk, and so it was a big success, that system. You know, I say, well, what happened in the last decade? Well, you know, I think you're right. What happened? You know, Wall Street, when they stepped in and said, you know, let me just go back for a second before I say, you know, part of the reason that we're in the situation we are is that, you know, after the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, you had, you know, for the next several decades, you know, this kind of explosion in the global market of new economies like China and India and the other emerging markets coming on, they began to reform their financial systems, became more productive, and their economies became more productive. And the end result was kind of what I say in my book is a global ocean of capital that we hadn't seen before. And the banks, by you know, a decade ago, the banks, by the late 90s, Wall Street institutions went to Washington and said, you know, we've got this global ocean of capital. A lot of it wants to invest in the U.S. And they said, here's a way of our handling the capital that is, it'll be more efficient. And, of course, but that way was to securitize the capital. And, you know, that whole process of dicing and slicing it up, like making a giant salad and selling in diversified, you know, salad bowls. And, of course, we found out with the subprime that every once in a while there would be a speck of toxic waste under a piece of lettuce, and you didn't know where that piece was, and so it proved to be a fiasco. But basically the banks said, and the investment banks said to Washington policymakers and to the politicians, we want to diversify and use securitization and use this sophisticated paper to spread risk and deploy capital. On top of that, we want to leverage more than we had in the past. And amazingly, Washington said okay, whether it was Alan Greenspan at the Fed or whether it was at the Treasury, and the Clinton administration was in time, so it was in office at the time, and so it was bipartisan. They said, gave him a green light. And I use a sports analogy to explain what happened. For the first 5 years,
as long as it's not the Detroit Lions.
No. But, you know, I once played high school football, so I use this analogy. For the first 5 years, the varsity was on the team, the Wall Street varsity players, and they were able to kind of handle, not totally abuse the system, you know, they increasing leverage and deploying this sophisticated paper and you know this and suddenly this blizzard of complicated paper that became our financial system in the last decade. The first 5 years they were able to handle it. The last 5 years, instead of the varsity on the team, it was kind of like the junior varsity, and I call them the countrywides. These were just people who didn't know what they were doing, and they were greedy, and they were also incompetent. And so they said, well, if the varsity was leveraging by that amount, let's triple it. And if they were issuing, you know, X amount of mortgage-backed securities, let's issue 5X. And so, you know, the last 5 years were an absolute disaster where, you know, the incompetence came in and the less than talented, and they completely lost control of the system. So you're absolutely right. This was a fiasco of Wall Street's making.
All right, where do you get the book, The World is Curved?
Well, you can have Amazon and all the major bookstores. The book has gotten enormous of coverage. I got a note from President Clinton, former President Clinton, saying he had read the book and he thought it was one of the three most important books on this financial crisis. But it's been kind of received from, we had bipartisan support from both Republicans and Democrats, and the most common, I mean, not to brag, but the most common word to describe the book is prescient. David Brooks, a columnist in the New York Times, called it in his review astonishingly prescient, and David Ignatius, a writer on the Washington Post, called it compellingly prescient. I think the Wall Street Journal called it prescient. So
right.
My middle name is now prescient. So
we'll be back with final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Dr. Bruce Goldberg joins us, past life regressionist, but we'll come right back with David Schmick and take your final questions on Coast to Coast AM. And just a reminder, Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Pacific time for Streamlink members, our chat. So come on into the room, and seats fill up awfully fast. We're with David Schmick. Final segment here as we take your phone calls as well. David, let's talk a little bit more about your thoughts that it's not the financial risk that concerns you the most, it's the political risk. And again, what you mean by that?
Well, I mean that you have, you know, fundamentally, the financial, you know, what happens in a financial risk, people move to the sidelines, they take productive capital and they make it idle capital, usually putting it into treasury securities or other government securities. As I said, in the 30s, they'd stuff it in the mattresses. Political risk could take the remaining capital that's productive and move that out. But because, and political risk is any kind of international development that will, that causes uncertainty. This period right now is a lot of people, including myself, and I say this in my book, The World is Curved, that it's strikingly similar to a period of about 100 years ago. It was from 1880 to 1914, just before the beginning of World War One, a period of globalization, just as we've had the last quarter century, of rapid industrialization back then. You saw a lot of trade, international trade, capital move back and forth suddenly during that period across borders. And it was also a period of panics. You had the panic of 1903 and the panic of 1907, the panic of 1893, and a number of others. And then with the World War One, you saw a total breakdown mm-hmm. of the whole international system, in which suddenly countries became much more mercantilist, and they began elbowing each other out of the way. And you had, within a decade, a little more than a decade, you fell into the all the seeds were planted for kind of the collapse of the 30s. And there's a sense right now that we're in that kind of period where you're seeing, I look at the way China maneuvers around the world, cutting special deals for commodities, you look at the kind of frictions under the table, the tensions on trade between China and the Europeans and China, us, even the Canadians are having problems there. And you say, is this a period like 100 years ago, where we're moving from harmony? When the global economic pie is expanding, for some reason everybody loves each other, and when it starts to contract, everybody, the countries become irrational. I mean, you look at the Russians right now, and I think they're very capable of a lot of different things. I mean, they they're very, very unpredictable right now.
Absolutely. Let's go to Canada. As a matter of fact, Serge in Montreal, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Serge.
Hello. Good day, George.
Thank
you. Good day, David.
Thanks for calling.
Gentlemen, I would like to know, wouldn't it be beneficial for the economy to be nationalized, if they nationalize all electrical companies and new inventions, like the Bucky paper, which conducts electricity as well as copper? They could cut the household electrical bills in half in that way.
If they wanted to. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I don't know how. I mean, the question is not just the existing supply. It would be, new supplies. And I don't know how effective the government would be at finding new supplies. But I think the essence of your point is that the status quo right now is not acceptable. And I would tend to agree with that. I don't know if I'd be that confident that I would want to rely on the government to produce new supplies of energy.
Okay, Serge, thanks for your call.
Particularly
next
new, because where we're going is, we're obviously talking about new innovative sources. I assume that's going to be some guy in his garage somewhere is going to figure something out.
Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia. Kelly, it's your turn. Go ahead, Kelly.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
David, I've got a question about the FDIC. Hypothetically, if you had no debt, your house was paid off, you no car loans, no credit card debt, what would you do with your cash? I mean, feel free to disagree with any of these points, but there's no market confidence. The dollar may collapse. You can't easily open a foreign bank account. It's said that the gold markets are manipulated by the central banks. And who knows if the FDIC has enough funds? They may go broke, and plus they have 99 years to pay it back.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to probably have to put money into the FDIC to recapitalize that. It's coming. You know, it's funny. I've been looking at the gold market. It's very, you know, one of the problems in the past is that, you know, as you say, it's very easily manipulated. The central banks are sitting on a lot of gold, and they also, you know, I noticed the Swiss, surprisingly, they used, at least my suspicion is, they used the Russians to do a lot of their gold sales, because the Swiss, I think, as I mentioned earlier in this program, you know, the exposure of their banks is so huge that the government doesn't have the resources to to bail out the banks even if they wanted to. But they have started to sell some of their gold, and they use the Russians to do the sale, and it's kind of like they think it's secret, but everybody hears about it. But I do, you know, you have to look at it and you say, over the long run, if in fact we move from a several years of a hyper, kind of a disinflationary scenario to one in which, as I mentioned earlier, the central bank says, we're going to monetize the debt and have more inflation because of all this mountain of debt, then, the gold market has got to soar. It's got to soar big time.
True. Okay, thank you. Let's go next. Beth in Knoxville, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I was wondering, I'm sure you thought about this, but do you think that some of this money that's gone toward this bailout, and we've seen no effect in the economy, perhaps this money could have gone toward something else?
Yeah, it's interesting. The Treasury's, the Obama's designee for the director of the National Economic Council, I guess, what you call him, the economic czar for Obama, is Larry Summers, the former Harvard professor and former Clinton Treasury Secretary. Larry sent a letter to the congressional leadership today, which both the House and Senate and the Republican and Democratic leaders. So, and of course, when you send a letter like that, it takes about, 2.5 seconds before it's leaked.
Yeah.
It's all over Washington. I got a copy immediately. But the letter basically said, for the second half of the bailout money, the second $350, they instructed the Congress and the Bush Treasury that the Obama wanted to carefully
debate it. Right?
Yeah. He wanted to target that. And they wanted to be able to use that for broader than just helping the banks, to look at individuals with credit card problems, and it was a pretty broad-based use of it. So I think they're kind of pulling away, because ultimately the banks are sitting on mountains of cash, as I said earlier, mountains of capital. They don't, obviously they have reasons for not lending, but it's not like they're, they're sitting on nothing, and they have plenty. So I think the Summers and Obama have decided we're going to divert at least the second half of that amount for maybe purposes that help average people a little more.
Do you think it's refreshing that we have this administration change right now?
Well, I think I think one of the geniuses of our system is that we have these changes. And you can see in parliamentary systems, oftentimes they just go on and on and on. And you could tell that the current crowd that's leaving, they're just out of gas. I mean, they don't.
A long time ago.
They just don't have. I think maybe it was that the whole terrorism thing just sapped them of their energy. And I have no doubt that there's probably a story there that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
That is pretty frightening that they were all worried about, but they just didn't have any vision or any creativity when it came to dealing with this financial crisis. And I think, it's probably, we're very, very lucky that, that we're having this transition. And I know a lot of Republicans who kind of feel the same way. They just say, look, you just need a change. And I would say that I've been very pleased that Obama, he seems to want to be a leader of the whole country, and that's very important right now. And I hope he continues that. That this is we're in a post-partisan age.
Well, he'll get his moment, David.
Yeah,
he'll get his moment. Let's see what he can do with it. Los Angeles, we go. Michael, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, my perspective, and it is perspective, is that we have a Congress that could not be more corrupt if you put them in a laboratory. That's the first point. Congress gives away $1 trillion to the banks in the hopes that something good will happen. 90 days later, they're telling us not that they don't know what happened, not in oversight, not in the marketplace, and to believe that the people who broke the system are going to fix it is extremely risky. And it doesn't take a financial genius or even a rocket scientist to recognize that it's the same old, same old. You know, just from 1998, where we had a $5 trillion national debt, today it's approaching $15 trillion in just 10 years. And to think that, you know, this because there's two ways for the banks to go. The front door is the marketplace, you know, making loans or investments. The back door is through government. And all government does is they can attach all the liens they want on taxpayers, their assets, their incomes. And I don't think that the people of this country, the working people of this country, working stiffs, if you will, I don't think they're going to give it up because they don't have it.
Yeah, well, they, you know, the
it's
banks,
fuzzy math.
What they've set up is the ultimate hedge. In other words, you can take all the risk you want, because you got the sucker, the taxpayer, and he's the hedge. She's the hedge. She's, in other words, she's the safety, you know, for the bailout. And I agree. You know, it's what I find interesting is how little the, you know, members of Congress know about Wall Street. They seem to kind of worship these institutions like these are marbled, or hauled, you know, oak paneled, roomed, you know. Institutions of huge importance. Anybody on Wall Street in the last who's been there in the last 10 years will tell you this, that all the talent, I mean the big hotshot talent that was at these big institutions, they've all left. They're all in small hedge funds and private equity firms and venture capital firms. Nobody stayed with the big institutions, particularly in the last 5 years. Even a firm like Goldman Sachs, you think, oh, that was the most prestigious financial institution, you know, in the country. You know, all the big talent moved off a long time ago, particularly when they went public. So these are kind of the second level or the third level guys. This is not the big talent group, and yet Washington treats them like they are. They can do no wrong, and they need a bailout. Well, we have to because they've come down to say, you know, that they need X amount. I was amazed how quickly the Congress, you know, several months ago, just rolled over and didn't ask any questions. I mean, I'm not Herbert Hoover in saying, you know, you do nothing and turn them away. But no questions, no controls, no constraints, nothing. And it was just amazing how little they understood that these are not, you know, these are institutions that needed tough questioning, and they needed, you know, they needed somebody very knowledgeable to say, if we give you this money, we want to know how it's going to be spent so it helps the average person.
Wasn't Congress kind of bullied too into approving this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was kind of a combination of the congressional leadership and Hank Paulson that came in and said, let me tell you, if you want to be responsible for Armageddon, don't vote for this. You know, and it was one of the great, scam operations. They should have said, look, let's take a week, even a week, and think about this carefully, and think about the amount of money we're turning over with no conditions. It's just the amount of influence and control we're giving with no strings attached. It's just amazing.
I still want to know why they bailed out AIG.
Well, you know, it comes down to two words, Goldman Sachs. Hank Paulson didn't bail out Lehman Brothers.
Nope.
And the general assumption is
Stearns.
They bailed out Bear Stearns, not Lehman Brothers, but because Lehman, you know, he didn't like those guys. He didn't like the head of Lehman. And part of it was a calculation that wouldn't affect the economy or the broader financial system. Well, it was a miscalculation. It was a fiasco. And so, but they quickly bailed out AIG, and I think because they said, that Goldman Sachs would go down. But, you know, it was just an amazing period of Congress. Just as your caller said, it's kind of legalized corruption. You know, it's not like they're taking, you know, brown paper bags full of cash. It's just, it's worse. It's legalized corruption and both ignorance and also enormous conflicts that just go on.
Let's go to Los Angeles. Andy, take it away. See if we can get you in here. Go ahead, Andy.
You have a great show, George. And David, thanks for your openness in alerting the American people to what's going on. I have a question and a comment. First of all, the question. I've had two multimillionaires, both from Beverly Hills, last 5-6 years, both live in mansions, who told me their wealth is like in the 10 to the $30 million range. They both told me that, in their opinions, independently, they told me that they believe the U.S. government is out to break the millionaires and that they want a two-class system, as you see in much of the world, the super-rich billionaires and then the rest of us. Look, get your opinion of that. And also, what do you think about an idea where the best and brightest minds from Harvard, from the greatest in the U.S. and the world got together with a brain trust of ideas.
Okay, well, let's get his reaction to that because we're going to run out of time. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess on the first part, you know, you do have there is kind of a rising tide of class warfare. My concern is that when Washington politically decides to go after the rich, what the people who usually get hit are not necessarily the billionaires, because they have the ability to hire, you know, lawyers and lobbyists and the rest. Warren Buffett's not going to worry. It's usually the guy who has, you know, a law firm, and or he has a small service company, and on paper he's, you know, worth. You know, he feels like he's upper middle class, but he's technically rich. They're the ones that go after. She's taking a lot of risk running that small company or that small law firm. You know, and that's the ones to me. These two individuals you talk to, they're the ones who are feeling vulnerable because they don't have anyone to go to Washington to protect them. And the big boys do. So I think that's, it's kind of, you know, there's a, if you look at,
David, the clock's going to get us, my friend.
Yep.
All right. Thanks. The world is curved. Up next, Dr. Goldberg, Bruce Goldberg, trends expert on reincarnation.